Philippians, chapter 3. The letter to the Philippians, chapter 3. We started this last week. It's a very crucial passage. Here is the dividing line between true and false Judaism. It's no less than that. What is true Judaism? What is biblical Judaism? What is Judaism of Moses and of the prophets? That's what we have in this passage that is underlined before us. I'm going to read from verse 1. Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. For me to write the same things to you is not tedious, but for you it is safe. Beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, beware of the mutilation. For we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit, rejoice in Messiah Yeshua, and have no confidence in the flesh, though I also might have confidence in the flesh. If anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. But what things were gained to me, these I have counted loss for Messiah. Last week we dealt with the first four verses. Remember what he says about verse 2, beware of dogs, that means apostates. Beware of evil workers, false disciples. Beware of the mutilation. And then he explains what he means, for we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit. He calls them the mutilation because they insisted that you cannot have a living relationship with God unless you are circumcised and keep the law. That's why he uses that term, mutilation. He said that's not true, not true to Moses, it's not true to the prophets. Moses said to the people that came out of Egypt, who were all circumcised, circumcise your hearts and be no more stiff-necked. In other words, you have the physical symbol, but it's no use until your hearts are circumcised. And without that, the physical symbol has no validity. And then in Romans 2 we read, shall not the uncircumcision which keeps the law judge you who by circumcision transgress the law? Isn't your circumcision then to be counted uncircumcision? You see the challenge here. Circumcision in its right place is valid. It is valuable. It is a sign of the covenant that God made with between himself and Abraham and all Abraham's physical descendants. It has been the mistake of the church to say that baptism has replaced circumcision, because circumcision does not give you a passport into heaven, and nor should baptism be viewed in that light either. Unfortunately, those who believe in that, mainly those who believe in baptizing infants say they have been brought into covenant with God, and however much they protest, what they're really saying is this person, by having going through the rite, has been admitted into the family of God. Now neither the one is true nor the other. It's not the outward that makes you a member of God's family. It is the heart. It has to be the circumcision of the heart. It has to be in the spirit. And that's why we read in verse 3, we are the circumcision who worship God in the spirit. How much they make of this. We will be coming back to this because it is a crucial area. It is a battleground. He says in verse 4, though I also might have confidence in the flesh, that is, as far as outward privileges are concerned, people couldn't hold a candle to me. That's what Shaul is saying here. I myself match anybody who wants to try and see whether he exceeds me in privileges. I can match them, I can surpass them. But it was all earthly attainments, earthly privileges. And he says here, if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. If it comes to outward attainments, outward privileges, and so on, I too have a right to boast. I have so many privileges. Let me list them for you. So in the following verses, he mentions seven things. First of all, verse 5, circumcised the eighth day. That is, he was born of Abraham. If he had been a proselyte, he would have been a few years old at any rate. Because a proselyte is someone who is old enough to make a conscious decision to take Yeshua, the God of the Hebrews, as his own God. So he says, no, I'm not a proselyte. I am born of Abraham. God had said to Abraham, he that is born of every male that is born among you, at 8 days old you shall circumcise him. It's interesting that the Judaizers, those who insisted that circumcision and the keeping of the law were necessary for salvation, are the ones he has in view here. When they came to Antioch, where there was a mainly Gentile congregation, they said to them, you read about it in Acts 15, unless you're circumcised and unless you keep the law of Moses, you cannot be saved. That was the fight there. And therefore, the disciples that were up there sent Shaul and Barnabas up to Jerusalem to the apostles to get their verdict. They wrote back a letter after major discussion on the subject. They said, some people have come out from among us. They have been subverting your souls, saying that you must be circumcised and keep the law. We didn't ever give them such a commandment. It is unbiblical. It is untrue to Moses. It's untrue to the prophets. That is how deep it goes. There was something that Moses did when the children of Israel were being bitten by fiery serpents, remember? They came to Moses and said, pray to God for us that he takes away the serpent from us. God said to Moses, make you a fiery serpent of brass. Nail it on a pole so that everybody can see it. And if anyone is bitten of a snake, when he looks on the snake, he shall live. It went contrary to all human reason. Why is it that looking at a replica, a brass replica, frees us from the venom of the snake that is going through our body? But when people obeyed and believed, as Lionel underlined, not only believe, but obey. Believe and obey. When they believed and obeyed, and they looked to that brass serpent nailed to the pole, they lived. Unfortunately, that thing which God had blessed for the people became a trap, because it became an idol. As the years went by, they began to revere it. A relic! We've got to worship this. They burned incense to it. For hundreds of years, people worshiped this thing. And then came along a king called Hezekiah. He said, enough of this. He took that revered relic, he smashed it to pieces, and he called it Nehushtan. The word for serpent is Nahash. So it was a pun. Nehushtan, piece of brass. Worthless piece of brass. It was only useful as far as God meant it to be, and it only had a limited time of usefulness, and that's when the snakes were biting them. After that, it was not to be revered. That's why we don't have shrines. We don't go pilgrimages anywhere. We do go up to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover or the Feast of Tabernacles, but it's not in the same sense that we revere things. So we see here that these two areas, circumcision and good works, insisted upon by the Judaizers for salvation, were being taken outside the realm of their intended usefulness. And when they are taken outside the realm of their usefulness, or when they are used in a way that God never sanctioned, they are no longer a blessing, they can be a curse. Here's another example. Gideon, that famous judge that delivered his people from the Midianites with 300 men, when his soldiers said, "What can we do for you? Will you be a king over us?" He said, "No way, no way, the Lord will be your king." Then he had a thought. "Well, why don't you give me those golden earrings from your prey, from those people that you conquered? Give me your golden earrings." "Certainly," they said. They spread a cloth and they took the earrings of their enemy, their conquered enemy, threw them in. Soon he had a big sheet weighed down with golden earrings. He took some of that gold and melted it down and made it a golden ephod. Now the ephod was the priestly garment that the high priest wore, or the priests or his sons wore, when they were serving God. He only meant it to be a replica. What happened? All the children went whoring after it. All the children of Israel, all the people of Israel, worshipped this thing. It became a snare to Gideon, the Bible says. God had told his people in the Torah, "You shall not bring a cursed thing into your house, lest you become a curse like it." And an idol is a cursed thing. Anything that's an idol is a cursed thing. What happened to Gideon? All his sons were murdered. The only one that survived was the son of his concubine from Shechem. He was the murderer. The curse came upon a good man because he overlooked God's warning. How solemn the warning is for you and for me. Nothing, nobody must take the place of God in our lives. God must be supreme. So we see here, when circumcision is made an idol, or good works are made an idol, and a precondition for citizenship in God's family and in God's city, we are angering God, we're not pleasing Him. How strange. He says here, the next thing he says, of the stock of Israel, "I am descended from Abraham, from Isaac, and from Jacob." The stock of Israel, that was a great privilege. If we go back to Romans chapter 9, we'll see there the great privilege that belongs still to the people of Israel, but the benefit of it cannot be theirs until they receive the one through whom God bestows it. That is Messiah. Romans 9, verse 3 to 5. "For I could wish that I myself were accursed from Messiah, for my brethren, my countrymen according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom pertain the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the service of God, and the promises, of whom are the fathers, and from whom, according to the flesh, Messiah came, who is over all, the eternally blessed God." Amen. Incidentally, we see here one of the texts which make it very clear that Yeshua, our Messiah, is no less than God made man for us. "I am of the stock of Israel, and all these belong to me, especially Furthermore, he says in verse 5, I am of the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin was the brother of Joseph. He was the son of the beloved Rachel. The tribe of Benjamin was famous for its history. One of its judges was Ehud, the son of Barak. Interesting, we've got a prime minister in Israel called Barak. Ehud was one of the judges of Israel. Saul and Jonathan. Saul, the first king of Israel, and Jonathan, his brother. Mordecai and Esther came from the tribe of Benjamin. And now Shaul himself, the great Shaliach, he came from that tribe. It was the only tribe that was loyal to the family of David, besides David's own tribe of Judah. We find the blessings of Jacob and of Moses. Here's the blessing of Moses. The beloved of the Lord shall dwell by him, and he shall dwell all day between his shoulders. That's the blessing of Benjamin. Jerusalem, the holy city, was actually in the border of Benjamin, just inside the southern border. Benjamin was just north of Judah. And Jerusalem sat just on the border, just inside Benjamin's territory. So Benjamin could boast, Jerusalem, the royal city, is really legally within our territory. It is now a shared territory, but it was given to us by God. So there's lots to boast about belonging to the tribe of Benjamin. We also read about them that they were expert. They were left-handed and they were expert. Someone said the right side of the brain controls the left side of the body, and the conclusion is any left-handed person is in their right mind. So if any of you are left-handed, you've got the bouquet. We read also about Shaul, a Hebrew of the Hebrews. He means, I'm not a Hellenistic Jew. I am a Jerusalem Jew. Although I was born in Tarsus, my mother tongue was Hebrew, not Greek. I verily am a Jew, said Shaul, born in Tarsus, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel. Today, if he was saying that, he'd say, I'm not a Reform, I don't belong to the Reform synagogue, not to the conservative, not even to the Orthodox synagogue. I am a Hasid. I belong to the Hasidim, the Hebrews of the Hebrews, they were called. And one more thing, he says in verse 5, concerning the law, a Pharisee, contrasted with the Sadducees and their view of the law. I am a Pharisee. The Lord Yeshua said to his disciples and to the multitude, the Pharisees are the true interpreters, the best interpreters of Moses. So whatever they tell you that Moses has written, whatever they tell you to observe, that you should do and that you should observe. But he added a caution. It's in Matthew chapter 23. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Not the Sadducees, because Moses believed in the supernatural and taught of it. Moses believed in the resurrection and taught it. The Sadducees denied both. So the scribes and Pharisees are closest. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. That saying, don't do as I do, do as I say, applied to the Pharisees as well. They were very great preachers, but they didn't practice what they preached. However, what they said was closest to the mark, and therefore they were to be followed. When Shaul stood before the Sanhedrin, he said, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called into question. So many people criticize him for saying that, because immediately he said that there's almost a riot between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But he's putting his finger on the crux of the matter. Later on, before Agrippa, he said, why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? Our teaching is not only about the death of Messiah, but the resurrection. They go together. You cannot separate them. Then he says in verse 6, concerning zeal, persecuting the church. I really thought I was being zealous for God by persecuting his people. And I surpassed everybody in that. Later on, before King Agrippa, he says, I verily thought within myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Yeshua of Nazareth, which thing also I did. And not only thought I should do it, I went ahead and put my money where my mouth was. I even persecuted them to strange cities. His zeal for God was certainly zeal, but it was not according to knowledge. He found out he was violently persecuting his own Messiah by doing what he is doing. There are some people like that. They think they're being zealous for God. The Lord Yeshua said, they that kill you will think that they are really serving God by doing so. And all the time they're tragically mistaken. Here's an example in Isaiah chapter 48. It's a sad verse, but it just shows how far wrong we can be, and all the time we think we are right. Shouldn't that give us pause when we are burning up with righteous indignation against something or somebody? Wait a bit. You might be the one that's mistaken. You're so angry at this person or at that situation. You may suddenly find out, oh no, like Shaul did, I'm wrong. I thought they were. In Isaiah 48, God speaks to his people, verse 1. Hear this, O house of Jacob, who are called by the name of Israel, and have come forth from the wellsprings of Judah, who swear by the name of the Lord, and make mention of the God of Israel, but not in truth or in righteousness. For they call themselves after the holy city, and lean on the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name. I have declared the former things from the beginning. They went forth from my mouth, and I caused them to hear it. Suddenly I did them, and they came to pass, because I knew that you were obstinate, and your neck was an iron sinew, and your brow bronze. Sad, isn't it? Here they are, they really feel that they are the cat's meow, to use a modern turn of phrase. And all the time they were so wrong. Concerning zeal, persecuting the church. And then, verse 6, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. As far as the externals of the law were concerned, the ceremonials of the law, nobody could put a finger on me. I dotted my I's, I crossed my T's, but it was the blamelessness of the scribes and of the Pharisees. The Lord Yeshua said to his disciples in the Sermon on the Mount, unless your righteousness surpasses the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will in no way enter the kingdom of heaven. He is not saying to his disciples there, it's in Matthew 5 verse 20, he is not saying there, you've got to be a little better than them. He's really saying to us there, you've got to have a righteousness that is totally other. Because they believe they're going to be saved by their good works. And it is not by good works that we are saved. Moses never taught it. The prophets never taught it. That's how far the Judaism of today has gone away from the Bible, because it teaches Zechut Avot, the merits of the ancestors. It teaches that we help God along a little bit. Yes, we do the best we can, then we ask His help where we've just failed a little bit. There are other religions that teach that too. It's the hallmark of every false religion to say that you are saved by faith plus, or by grace plus good works. No way. You never find it in the Bible. The righteousness in the law, he says, I was blameless. What did the Pharisees do? You have only to read the writings. Pirkei Avot. There you go. You can get a copy of that paperback in the Jewish bookstores. The Ethics of the Fathers. Or if you want to read the Talmud, you'll find all the way through this recurrent strain. Good works, good works. Without good works you shall not enter heaven. The Bible says it is only by faith you are saved, and then your faith produces good works, but it is after the fact, not before. That's what Lionel was underlining in the Devar Torah. He says, I was blameless. Like that man went up to the temple to pray, God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are. And he was telling the truth. He was not a liar. He was not an adulterer. He was not an extortioner. He wasn't even like that tax gatherer. And in a sense, every true believer can say with great humility, God, I thank you that I am not as other men are, not because of what I have done, but because what you have done for me. This Pharisee was wrong because he said, I, all the way through. It's me, my self-accomplishment. That's where he went wrong. That's where Shaul was going wrong. Oh, he said, I suddenly realized, if you look at Romans chapter 7, I suddenly realized the law doesn't confine itself to the outward action. It aims at the heart. And the moment I realized this, I realized I was dead in my sins. I thought I was alive. I was a member of the living dead. I was dead while I lived. The blamelessness of the scribes and of the Pharisees. The righteousness Yeshua said we need, that would surpass their righteousness, is the one that God bestows. Here it is, Isaiah chapter 61. Isaiah 61. Verse 10, I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he has clothed me with the garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorns herself with her jewels. Where does that righteousness come from? From God. Not from man. It is the gift of God. Not of works, lest any man should boast. So he says, verse 7, but what things were gained to me, these I have counted loss for Messiah. Why would he say such a thing? What he's really saying is, all these things gave me honor and prestige in Israel, but I relied on them for my salvation, and therefore they became my worst enemies. Yeshua said to the Pharisees, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for whatsoever is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. God's searching eye is on us. What do you rely? The king of Assyria said to Hezekiah, on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me, and Satan may come to you and say the same. I trust in the ever-living one, says the hymn. His wounds for me shall plead. I need no other argument. I need no other plea. It is enough that Yeshua died, and that he died for me. What a wonderful thing that you and I can say that. It is a gift from God. He said, I counted it loss for Messiah, loss for Christ. The word loss there is the same word used about shipwreck. If I had continued trusting in that, I would have suffered shipwreck. I would have been drowned in the sea of my good works. I don't want to be shipwrecked. How interesting. That reminds me of the night I became a believer. The preacher said the disciples got in with Yeshua into a boat to cross over to the other side. There was a big storm, and the waves filled the ship, but the ship could not sink because Yeshua was in the boat. Do you have Yeshua in? He said, do you have Jesus in your boat? That was the night when I took Jesus into my boat. That night I understood I needed him or I would suffer shipwreck. How interesting that the simplest things get through. I'd heard one or two others before. It all gone over my head, but that really got to me. That really clicked with me. We don't want to suffer shipwreck. We want to avoid this danger of dangers. And he goes on to say in verse 8, yet indeed, I also count all things lost for the excellence of the knowledge of Messiah, Yeshua my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish, that I may gain Messiah. In Greek, it's literally like this, but yes, indeed, Allah menun ge. That's how it is in the Greek. But yes, indeed, a very strong affirmative. He says, I count all things loss for the excellence of the knowledge of Messiah. If anything comes into competition with it, out it goes. Messiah did the same for us in a different way. He counted everything but loss in order to save us. He made himself of no reputation. We read that being in the form of God, he did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bond servant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Messiah emptied himself for us. And now, in another sense, are we prepared to let everything go for him? Are we prepared to say, I'm not going to boast about my background, my status, my good works? I'm going to trust only in Messiah and what he has done for me. Those valid ceremonies and privileges that Shaul had enjoyed disqualified him from Messiah only when wrongly substituted for him. They were still, in a sense, his glory. It was no mean thing to be able to say what he had said about himself. All those things really and rightly belonged to him. And when he talks about counting all these things but rubbish, he means when it comes to relying on them, it's worse than rubbish. They were never meant to depend on. They were never made to depend. Even spiritual blessings. You've been saved, you've been walking with God, you've had precious experiences. Have those experiences become your staff, your crutch. You keep looking back to that blessed experience you had so many years ago. There's a certain man in a prayer meeting in England. His prayers were, forgive the expression, as dull as ditch water. He was as dry as dust when he prayed. And every time he stood up to pray, people braced themselves, oh, here goes. But this one time, God came and lifted him out of himself. His voice deepened. He began to pray with an unknown fervency, and he carried everybody with him. He went on at great length, but God was in that prayer meeting, and God was using that man, and everybody was blessed to their soul. So was he. The next week he tried it again, and it was like a lead balloon. Don't rely on your spiritual privileges. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Yeshua's name. On Messiah, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. That's the message. That is biblical Judaism. A total reliance on Messiah. The Talmud comes so close to it. All the prophets wrote of nothing but of the days of Messiah. That's what the Talmud says in Sanhedrin. How near we come to telling the truth, and then we go and spoil it and deny it all by our actions. Well, we'll have to leave it, God, and come back to it next week. But you see what is over against it? The excellency of the knowledge of Messiah, Yeshua, my Lord. When those two things come in competition, the one is discarded in favor of the other. If you have glass beads in your hand, and someone offers you diamonds instead, you're going to hold on to those glass beads, going to drop them like a hot cake and reach out for those diamonds. That's the contrast that is being described here. May God put his diamonds in your hands. That's my prayer for every one of you.